Okay, so I thought that I want to show you a few slides on the paper that we put in the archive recently. And recently, I mean this was in July. And there was also a related paper by Alexei Goshkov, you know, in September. I think that hopefully good ideas always sort of appear independently, I guess. And this is a talk that's sort of more on atomic physics. So all of the talks that we always hear, sort of quantum many-body physics, and then people say, well, we have optical lattices, and then they take off, and then they point to Emmanuel as the one who does it then in the lab. So my attempt here is to try to think a little bit ahead on the atomic physics side and think about ideas of manipulating atoms by coherent optical forces on the scale of, let me say, simply tens of nanometers, which is the sub-wavelength scale. So we would like to do what we normally do in optics on the wavelength scale, on the scale which is much smaller. And the reason I would like to explain are the following. So I spend a lot of time motivating this thing and afterwards tell you how we do it. And we would like to do these things with far-field optics. You can always do this, of course, by bringing atoms close to surfaces, but that's not what I want to do here. The mechanism, so this is the how, will essentially be what people call geometric potentials. This is even on resonance optical forces that derive from non-adiabatic corrections to Born-Oppenheimer potentials. And of course, the reason why we want to do it is this: at the end, we would like to develop sort of a novel toolbox, a new toolbox on the atomic physics side to do things that we do at the moment, for example, Hubbard models or something like this, and on a much smaller scale. This is the basic motivation. And maybe the starting point for the discussion should be that I briefly summarize what we do with an optical lattice landscape and what sort of the ideas behind are, why we do it like this, and what the limitations are. So all of you know this thing, and have heard it 100 times. We take counterpropagating laser waves, and we make an intensity patterns which an atom sees as an optical potential over here. So it's a sine square k, and k essentially is the wave number of the light. It's lambda over 2. This is the dipole force. And the argument behind it is that we have, of course, an AC Stark shift. We take a laser that we detune very far from resonance, either to the blue or the red side. And the Stark shift that we have here will be proportional to the intensity. And we would like to have very large detuning over here from resonance. So the reason simply being that we would like to suppress the effects of spontaneous emission, which is decoherence. And so by going very far off resonance and by sort of using lowest order perturbation theory for the light shift, the combination of this gives this, and this implies, of course, that we have lambda over 2. Then, of course, we take this Hamiltonian, you know, we calculate our Bloch bands, we write them down, you know, the Bloch bands here, the single particle pictures indicated down here, then we go over to the Hubbard model. And you write them down the Hubbard model, you know, when we have here hopping and then on-site interactions and maybe some off-site interactions here too. The important point is that the single particle hopping that we have over here, at the end of the day, is, of course, confined by the fact that we have a finite lattice spacing, and the lattice spacing is lambda over 2, by what we call the recoil energy. So there's a fundamental limit here that comes from the lattice spacing. For a given lattice spacing and a given mass, you know, there's an upper bound to what this hopping can be, and this is setting the scale of all of the energies. This is the kinetic energy, how particles are moving around. And at the end, you know, these energy scales that are given by this lattice constant should be then compared with parameters like temperature. And at the end, I guess it is always a question of, you know, can we make our temperatures low enough that even if you do things like J squared divided by U or T squared divided by U perturbation theory, or that we have off-site interactions here that can be extremely small. So in the recent experiment by Francesca Pellerino on dipoles in optical lattices, you know, these interactions were 80 hertz, and you have to come up with temperatures if you would like to see corresponding phases that are correspondingly small. So in this sense, I would sort of argue that this is one example where the lattice spacing or the fact that we are working with light, that we create optical potential with light, is a fundamental limit to atomic Hubbard models. And we would like to go below that and come up with ideas how to manipulate or sort of make coherent light forces on the scale, which is much smaller. And this is sort of a series of animations that takes you now through what we want to do. So the first thing I want to say is up here, it's kind of fundamental that we get the sine square out. So sine square comes from the fact that we just had proportion to intensity, and the intensity is sine squared. But you might ask yourself, can we do a potential which instead of this sine squared is maybe more something like a chronic Banach type potential over here with a size or width which is much less than the wavelengths? So this would be a chronic Banach model, and then maybe you get sort of, you know, greedy and say, well, if I can do lambda over 2, why not lambda over 4, maybe lambda over 8 or something like this. So in this sense, you would like to go to a situation where you make lattice spacings for all of these structures much, much smaller than the wavelength. And of course, you would like to do it without changing the wavelengths itself. Of course, you can always argue that you take some very blue laser over here. But this, of course, is not the point that you might actually ionize atoms. So we would like to use now non-linearities in the atoms to achieve something like this. The question is how you want to do that. And there have been different answers out there. So we wrote a paper in 2008 about some of these things. And Jean Dalibard had something last year where they had ideas how to do that. But I would like to do or talk here about something which is slightly different than this. And I would like to explain to you now the story where we get bumps that are sub-wavelengths, and then sort of tell you a story how we can use these things in the context of these many-body physics or the kind of physics that comes out, which is sort of, you know, different and maybe new relative to what one normally does. Okay? And there's sort of two ingredients. Okay? The first ingredient is this: how do we get little bumps, you know, that are sub-wavelengths broad here in the sense of this chronic Banach model? And the answer will be that we'll be talking about dark states in lambda systems. So some of you will tell me that when you talk about a dark state here, then this sounds like a contradiction. Because if you have a dark state, then it means that the atom doesn't see the light. So why should it then see a little bump down here? But you will afterwards see that we will get non-adiabatic corrections to these dark states. And this will be the reason why we get these things out. And let me also emphasize at this point that, of course, the usual paradigm up here is the off-resonant AC Starks effect. You would like to go off-resonant. By being in a Stark state down here, we are from the very beginning sort of dark. We don't see the light. So the story that I will tell you afterwards will also work for resonant as well as for off-resonant excitation. For single particle physics, you can go exactly on resonance if you want to and do all of these things. It's a coherent optical force. But if you would like to do many-body physics, I think there would be a very good reason to go off-resonance to suppress maybe some collisions that may happen if you go close to resonance and some atomic loss. And then there's number two. As I said, you know, the way how these things arise will be to this dark state. There will be sort of conservative non-adiabatic corrections that come out here. So here I try to summarize one motivation why we would like to do that. Think of all of these experiments that people are doing at the moment, like in bilayer systems. And you know, this is done with polar molecules, but also maybe with magnetic atoms. You make two layers, and the usual way of making two layers for atoms is this, that you simply say, let me take an optical lattice in this direction, pick out two wells, fill them with atoms, and then, of course, they will interact. And if they are polar molecules, this is electric dipoles, and they interact much more strongly. So usually, this is the separation here will be lambda over 2. But we will afterwards, or sort of now in the following, ask the question if we can do a bilayer system, and we would like to do these things in free space on a scale where the distance between these layers is much less than the wavelengths. And then you can see that, you know, if you put magnetic dipoles that we have in these atoms in here, because of the small distance, you get very strong interactions that could be done with normal atoms. And this is really what we'll be after. So strong interaction, for example, pairing or the BC-PCS crossover that people have discussed here, or bilayer fraction quantum Hall. They would become accessible to the extent that we can realize a situation like this. And so let me take up this bilayer system here as an example, but then reduce it down even more. So what I had before was sort of, this is a standard optical lattice. And we have here the ground Vanier function. All of you know so well, this is lambda over 2, the lattice spacing that we had. And as I told you, we'll afterwards tell you the story how we get these sub-wavelength spikes over here. With a distance L, which is much smaller than the lambda over here. So let me try to motivate what we do here, for example, like this, that I would like to insert here this sub-wavelengths, you know, barrier over here, for example, in one of these wells. And you can see that this becomes sort of interesting if I take out one of these here. And I put atoms over here, for example, they had dipoles, you know, and this is a separation which is now very small. This is the tens of nanometers that I was talking about. Then at this point, you would get, for example, here two pipelines. I try to indicate them here. And you might want to make wires, and the wires now have scale of distance of about, I don't know, tens of nanometers of this sort. But you will afterwards also see that it sort of gives rise also to some other questions in the many-body context here. So what are the basic ingredients to doing that? So We make, of course, a standard optical lattice that we have over here. This is sort of one well. This is normally where we do our standard physics. This is just the one well over here, and we would like to split it, as I said. But this well over here can be generated by taking a standard optical lattice, and let me take two ground states. I call them here spin down and spin up. And I have an off-resonant lattice, and so this is the standard story that all of you know. But here in our case, a single lattice site will provide kind of the envelope for this trapping potential for the kind of physics that we would like to do. And the question is, of course, how do we get this barrier, you know, in between here, which is our wavelengths? And the answer is the scheme that we have here. And I would like to elaborate on this now a little bit more, because this is really the physics that we want to talk about. So the challenge or the question is this, you know, that we would like to have sub wavelength barriers that we insert in something that's sort of normally the ground state. So it's like cutting the ground state that we normally have in our Wannier functions into half. And in my story here, this would be sort of like two wires that go into the board over here. It would be two wires that are now close together on the scale. Well, a standard optical lattice, this may be, I don't know, 30 nanometers, the same number. The question is, you know, can we make a barrier that's smaller? So this is sort of the order of magnitude that we want to talk about. And there are sort of two ingredients in the story over here. And this is the sort of the interesting one. And this goes back to a paper that we wrote with Misha Lukin now quite some time ago. This was when we wrote our paper on sub-wavelengths light. And then Misha one day sent me an email and said, no, I have a much better idea to do sub-wavelengths resolution spectroscopy. And I will tell you now in the following what the idea behind this story was. And I will take this idea that we had over here, what we call the sub-wavelength resolution microscopy. This is a coherent version of what also Stefan Hell, for example, does. So I will explain this thing a little bit. This gives you sub-wavelength microscopy here. But I will afterwards then take a second, you know, bunch of ideas, which is an old paper by Ralf Doom. I think that Ignacio still knows, remembers Ralf. You know, he's now, of course, a famous program manager for us in Brussels. So it's good that, you know, program managers have history in science here. Yeah. And they wrote a paper which was very interesting. They talked about a long time ago about gauge structures in atom laser interactions. And here you can see the sentence confinement of atoms in a dark state lattice. So what I would like to do the following, take these ideas from here, but combine them with these ideas here to provide then sort of a new kind of a toolbox for manipulating atoms coherently on a scale which is much less than the wavelengths, at least in a certain sense. And I will talk about the barrier that I mentioned here before. Oh, okay, so this was so far introduction. And now let me switch over to the real physics, and I have a few slides that show you what the basic ideas are. This is now at the moment single atom physics.
What is the minimal width of this barrier?
If you wait a moment, I can show you, but it has many, many answers. Okay, so
okay.
So let's postpone the question. This is an important one, okay?
The K does not have nothing to do with the K of the standing wave that we...
No, that's right. I mean, this is for me, this one and the other one sort of is a K that has to do with this envelope wave function that has... So they are completely independent, yeah? Okay, so I guess maybe some of you know that in atomic physics, you know, whenever we see lambda systems like this, and so we have a laser that's driving a transition over here, we might go on resonance, but off resonance over here, and we put in two fields. One we call C for coherent drive. You imagine that this is actually a very strong field. And this is sort of a weak probe field that we get something which is called dark states. But I would like to look at these dark states now in a somewhat maybe sort of unusual way, or sort of based on what these papers before had in. So I would like to make now this thing here. And if you want, you can think for the moment. We're doing single particle physics that we go on resonance over here. And we have a three-level lambda system. But I would like to make this strong laser over here a standing light wave, sine kx in space. So let's do a very simple one-dimensional model. And so
Omega p, does that have any, that's constant in space?
I want it to be at the moment to you know, I would like to look at the model now. They have 1D motion, and I want this to come from one side. If you would tilt this thing, which we can do, we get things like spin orbit couplings and all of these kind of things. So that's an extra story. So at the moment, I would like to start out by saying that this omega p, I want this to be constant. And I don't want the spatial phase on this thing. But if you want, we can immediately put it in. But this is sort of the most simple part of the story here. Okay, so you can see that our atom has two ground states. Let me call them spin down and spin up. And so when the atom is moving along here, it will be exposed to these two light fields that we have over here. And I emphasize here that we got spontaneous emission, of course, in the excited state. This may be very strong. Normally, this is the killer. You know, if you do an optical lattice, if you did something like this near resonance with a standard optical lattice, of course, you would be dead because you would get a lot of heating from spontaneous emission. I want to convince you now that in the story that we have, this will be a small correction, and I will quantify then what this small means. And there's also another spacing over here, which is that I'm assuming now 1D model, so that I assume some transverse confinement also here. I don't have to do that, but let me do a 1D model here. And the answer to your question will at the end be that the smallest confinement that we can do is related to the transverse confinement. So in this 2D model. But let me come back to this point a little bit later. So we do a 1D model now in this configuration. And as I said, we can also tilt it, and then we get sort of spin orbit coupling here, but that's not what I want to talk about. So let me now sort of graphically present what we have over here as a sine wave that I'm plotting now here in space. And this is my omega c, where I said that the omega c is actually a very much larger amplitude than the omega p that we have over here. So the omega p is for me a constant, this thing over here. And the omega c that we have over here is much larger, but it has a zero, so it's much smaller. So you can see that we got regions in space over here where the omega c is much larger than the omega p, and also vice versa. Okay? So we have here two regions, you know, shaded by this, indicated by these two colors. So if an atom is moving now, here, if you think about it, as a classical atom, it will come to a region over here. For example, this field essentially is zero, but this field is very strong, then it moves to a region where this field is much stronger than this one over here, and then vice versa. So the atom is sort of moving here. And you can see right away, if you would like to quantify how broad these regions are that we have over here, where we have these inequalities that I indicated over here, then you can see that we can obviously now define a scale in space, which is, let's call it L over here. If I would like to find out where the border is of these two zones, you would put omega c, which is spatially dependent over here, equal to the omega p. This is the crossing point here. You ask how broad is this width over here. And it's essentially the scale of the lambda, but multiplied by epsilon. And epsilon is the ratio of this omega p divided by the omega c. So by having the ratio of these two Rabi frequencies over here, if I make them much smaller than 1, you can see that we can get regions in space over here that are much less than the lambda that you have over here. And this is, at the end, the mechanism that is behind the sub-wavelength spectroscopy, or microscopy, I should say. And now in the following, we would like to translate this spin pattern that we have over here, that the ground states see now completely different lasers, you know, indicated by these regions, into optical forces that are hopefully coherent. So an atom will sort of now move through this thing and see these different Rabi frequencies that switch now between these two situations. And the most simple model that you can write down here would be the one where you have, of course, now kinetic energy, and then you're writing down your 3x3 matrix that indicates the lambda system over there. You can see the coherent light field coupling the G1 ground state that up to the excited state. You got an excited state with some detuning. If you want, you can take this thing on resonance for the moment even. We have this gamma over 2 here. And we have here the omega p, which is this weak probe field. Because the smaller I take the omega p, you know, the smaller this reach will become over here. So this is one answer, but the answer is actually more complicated because I have to, in principle, look at the three-dimensional model here.
So these are G1, G2 are degenerate in the way you wrote it here, right?
They can be different hypertime ground states, and I just would compensate over here by taking different laser detunings. So I want Raman resonance now in the following to get my dark states out.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's why those zeros, you've compensated. You've taken, so in this case,
that's right.
They're not degenerate, you have right. Two different frequencies.
So this is written in a rotating frame where I've taken out. So in principle, there could be a Raman detuning over here, but I put this Raman detuning equal to zero over here because that's the situation that I want now in the following. Okay, so I'm going exactly to Raman resonance.
So is the physical picture, there's only very small regions in space where the two balance, and that's the only place where you get
if you wait a moment, I will try to explain now. Okay, you already set the head. Okay.
Just one question I can ask. Experimentally, usually one thing when omega c and omega p are very different in strengths, one problem that arises is that You know, we neglect coupling that this OMC laser can also induce some light shifts on the G2 to E transition, which you so far you say it does not at all influence the G2 to E transition. It's just on the transition.
So at the moment, I would like to be very close to resonance with my story over here. And then so there may be light shifts. You're saying that this light shift by coupling to some other levels up here might also shift it.
That's usually what we find, and especially when we work, I don't know, I mean, when we worked in, especially in regimes where omega C and omega P are very different, then omega C is very strong, for example, it can happen that this one induces light shifts on the other transition, which spoil the nice three-level system picture a little bit. So just...
Yes, I think that all of these kind of things will be at the end, you know, the reason, you know, what's the smallest value of L that you can pick over here. Yeah? So if you look at this Hamiltonian, I will afterwards show you, you know, results where we solve for the band structure, for example, that we get over here exactly in the sense of numerically, and we can also do it in perturbation theory. But I would like to present to you now what the basic picture is, how this sort of new kind of optical force now arise in this context. So let's first of all make the Born-Oppenheim approximation, which means that we would like to have very slow atoms. So let's sort of to zero order neglect this thing over here, diagonalize it, define a basis, which is now position dependent. And of course, everybody in quantum optics knows that if I give you a 3x3 matrix and diagonalize it, you find that there will be three eigenvalues, obviously, because it's a 3x3 matrix, and one of them will be zero. This is the famous dark state. And the dark state has energy equal to zero in this rotating frame. It has no admixture from the excited state up here. It's only a G1 and a G2. So this is completely flat in space, no optical potential, whatever, over here. And we got two bright states that are contaminated by the excited state over here. So the excited state is over here. And there will be some gamma loss rate. So these are two states that are completely unusable if you go close to resonance. And this is the one that's dark, and it's a certain linear combination of G1 and the G2. And you can see that this linear combination that you have in space over here, omega p and the omega c, will actually change in space. So this state over here will be a Born-Oppenheimer channel, you know, that will sort of change its identity as you go in space. But there's no excited state over here, and this is now the starting point. So another way of writing would be that the state, and we'll afterwards take this thing here as a channel function. This will be the relevant state, G1 and the G2 that we have over here. That we have a cosine and a sine. The cosine and sine in space, how it varies, will be just given by the ratio of these Rabi frequencies here. And so this means as you move to space, this dark state that we have over here, this eigenstate with energy equal to zero, will change its identity on the scale given by this scale L, which is the sub-wavelength scale, from G1 to G2. So it's like you will see afterwards a spin, which is spin up, and then it goes spin down and spin up, and it does it in this very small region of space.
So Peter, I have a very naive question. So what's the width of this wave packet that of the atoms? Mm-hmm. What is the width that this?
Well, we'll afterwards do, for example, here the Bloch functions in these things here. But we are going to use one of the barriers that comes out. I have them on the following slides. We want to insert them and then to do our two channels and so on. So we would like to create them. So let's wait a moment, okay? So at this point, I mean, this is single particle physics, and in this sense, almost trivial. You do sort of the obvious that you say that you write down your single particle wave function expanded in the channels. You call them E0. This is my dark state. You know, this is the one that has no excited state mix, no decoherence. But it also has no energy here. And then you got two bright channels over here, and they are very bad because they have very strong loss in spontaneous emission. So we note that this is sort of spin. Dependent and also x-dependent, you know, the identity of all of these states over here is changing now in space. This will be important. And of course, as we can always do with these things, we can arrange these things in the form where we write now for the three vector here. We can write this. This is Born-Oppenheim approximation. It's a non-abelian gauge potential that varies in space. And then we got some Born-Oppenheimer potential over here. And I will write this thing now down on the next line. It's a little bit more complicated because this is a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian over here. But nonetheless, you can do these kind of things. So this is sort of standard. And of course, we at the end would like to be in a situation, in the following, we'll see then why and how, where we want this to be a good approximation that we only keep the first term. At the end, we will solve the complete problem and convince ourselves to what extent it's true. But let me focus in at the end where all of the physics will be, that the wave function essentially will be the Born-Oppenheimer One, where we have the dark state, this gentle function over here. And this will be the single particle wave function that at the end then also we put then for many body wave function. So if I, for simplicity, put delta 0 and gamma 0 for the moment, and I write down this whole Hamiltonian out here completely, you can see the 3 by 3. You can see the three eigenvalues in space. This is 0, 1, and 1 over here. And this E of x is the one that you can see here in space how this thing varies. This is the upper bright state. This is the lower bright state. This is strong spontaneous emission, strong spontaneous emission. And you can see the dark state that you have in between. And the dark state over here is changing its identity in space on the sub-wavelength scale. So over here, this is dominantly G1, G2. Here's dominantly G1, and here's dominantly G2. And we got sub-wavelength regions in here, and I can make them, we can make them as small as we want them to be, modulo all of these constraints, by taking the imbalance between the two light beams, which is the omega C and the omega B, sort of small. Okay? So we, at the end, would like all of the physics sort of to appear down here. And we want these channels here, to not play a role. And we will quantify these things then afterwards. And let me sort of remark that, of course, if I write down this channel function, you can see that the particle moving in the dark state sees a potential zero over here. So it's completely flat. So nothing interesting will happen over here. Except, of course, that when the particle is moving in space, it's spin up, spin down, spin up, and spin down. It's changing its spin identity over here on a scale which is much less than the wavelength. So at this point, you might ask, what's the lifetime of this state? Because we have, of course, these coupling terms over here. And these coupling terms will couple this adiabatic state that we have over here, for example, to the bright state, which is below. And this one is very lossy. So if you have a coupling from this one down here, then this is very bad, because then you're dead at this point. And this would be the loss rate. So we would like to be able to work in the regime over here, where these couplings to the other channels that are indicated over here are actually very small.
But this is already now beyond von Oppenheimer.
This is exact at the moment. This is exact.
Right.
This is exact, except that I just, for simplicity of writing, I put this here. That's right. That's exact. So let's sort of look at what these couplings are. You can see that this zero over here, this thing is diagonal. So plus and minus are these two green ones over here. And this is the flat one that we... So it obviously goes like alpha prime over here. So alpha prime was this angle that I introduced here before. And you can see that epsilon was our small parameter. And here we got something like k epsilon in front, but there's an epsilon square down here in the denominator. And the first reaction may be that these non-adiabatic approximations will sort of scale with the wavelengths of the light. So you would say that it's probably just a condition that, you know, if you take the Rabi frequency, it's much larger than the recoil energy, then we are in business. But it actually turns out that because there's an epsilon in the denominator over here, these non-adiabatic corrections that we have in here actually can be quite large, you know, because it goes like one over epsilon. And it simply comes from the fact that if you got your particle moving, then it's changing in a very small region of space from spin up to spin down and vice versa. And this is non-adiabatic effects. Okay, so let's now try to analyze what they are and how we can use them. So this is just the same equation that I had before, and I multiplied everything out. And you can see that in the equation that we had over here, we had here an alpha prime term that we have to square. And this term appears now over here. You can see that in the last line over here, we get now an alpha prime square term here, which is now here two times this, and it has no off-diagonal terms. And then here for the bright states, this red thing over here will be a non-adiabatic correction to the dark state over here. So in other words, if I ignore this coupling over here for the moment that I decouple it, my dark state over here should actually be, if I sort of plot it here again, you know, this was my dark state. I get little bumps down here. And these little bumps here, I can work them out easily because they just come from this alpha prime, this non-adiabatic correction that I had. They have this type, and you can see that they go like epsilon squared here, or one over epsilon squared. And if you plot these things in space, you can see that for different values of epsilon, which is the ratio of these omega P and omega C, you get things that are essentially like spikes, like chronic Benning type potentials, which is just a blown up from this interior region,
so
that you
alpha.
Can make as small as possible, at least within the model that you want.
Yep. That's coming from the diamagnetic term, the alpha prime
square. That's right,
term.
Exactly. Right. Huh? And you can see that this is always repulsive over here. Huh? But you can make them small to the extent that epsilon is small. So the scale over here, as you can see, is this, that the peak height is epsilon r, that's the recoil energy, divided by epsilon squared. So if you make epsilon small, I mean, this thing can become pretty high. Of course, we should really watch out. If this potential over here starts to touch this potential up here, then the adiabatic decoupling that we assume over here would no longer be valid. And so I would like to argue at the very end of the day that we have here an optical potential that arises because of these geometric forces or whatever you might call these things that have this sub-wavelength structure. And on this level of approximation, these are completely coherent forces, even though at the moment we are doing single particle physics, we are, for example, here on resonance. So this is standard AC Stark splitting, and we want this to be small. But this can be, I don't know, 100 recoil units over here. And the separation over here is given by the Rabi frequency. So if I take Rabi frequency, they're very large. Don't have to be so large, actually. Then these bumps over here can be quite appreciable. And this is an on-resonance optical lattice with a sub-wavelength structure, but sort of. So this is conservative and has sub-wavelength bumps over here.
So what parameter allows you to ignore the coupling to the other states?
I'll come back to this.
Okay.
And I will show you results, and we work this thing out in some detail. So this will be part of my following discussion.
That's the other term, right? You didn't discuss that. That's the one you discussed, the alpha prime.
Yeah. Well, it's this term over here. I can see that we'd be coupling. And then at the end, we solve this exactly. We calculate the widths, then do the Bloch wave functions and all of these things. Okay.
There's really a mixture that happens already at the dark state, at the level of the dark state, that you don't get if you ignore the motion somehow, which you consider for an Oppenheimer, it's something you forget.
Right, it's a non-adiabatic correction. So what you can see with this bump is a non-adiabatic correction to Born-Oppenheimer. And because we have a small wavelength region, they can be very large, because then, you know, in the small region of space, you're modulating this thing. And so in this sense, you can make them large.
But somehow alpha prime, you know, you're doing it, this is a good approximation when alpha prime is small, but then alpha prime squared is smaller than alpha prime. So you would think these terms would be the terms that don't couple, like these ones are.
Can we come back to the coupling? I'll come back to the coupling afterwards. I just want to discuss the physics of this one here first, and then we come back to the coupling. Because this will be, what you talk about is sort of finite lifetime corrections. This will be the loss down here. Okay. And we have to quantify it, and this is what we do by solving it exactly, or even have some perturbative expressions in terms of some scaling. So I have here a few plots that sort of indicate to give you a feeling for different parameters. So this is going, for example, here on resonance. You give now, take certain Rabi frequencies, some unbalanced, you plot it. This is the bright state up here. This would be a standard AC Stark splitting, but this is on resonance. You would never use this as an optical lattice because this has very strong loss given by this gamma, which is over here. And for example, if I go now with the detuning on the red side, you can see that the lower state is sort of coming up and will eventually touch, and this is bad. Okay, it's not what we want, but it's getting closer and closer over here. This is for the tuning, which is on the blue side. You can see that the upper one is sort of coming in. This would be a blue detuned standard optical lattice if I go very far of resonance, and this is the dark state. So these are the standard optical lattices that you can see sort of emerging over here. But we are interested in the dark state, which is in the middle of all of this. Okay. And you can see at this point, sort of the adiabatic approximation probably breaks down, because here you can see that these upper potentials start to cross with this thing over here. So this is where you would get very strong channel mixing. And you can sort of see this. But if you look at this again, I mean, at the end, we will argue that we can use these sub-wavelength barriers over here. But you can also see that we get these other potentials that come over here. So actually, there's a possibility for engineering very complicated optical landscapes where you not only insert the barrier, you also get optical wells over here from the standard optical lattice, and you can do a combination of all of these things here. So this becomes an interesting way of combining this. And now you take the Rabi frequency is larger, you can always move these things away if you want to. So I have now a discussion of various points over here, the zero order adiabatic approximation, the first order, what we already discussed about, and then I will talk about the losses here, which are these non-adiabatic corrections that I mentioned before. So the summary at the moment is really this. To zero order adiabatic, no Born-Oppenheimer non-adiabatic correction, there's no optical potential, but we have a sub-wavelength structure in the internal state. So if you take an atom that's moving along over here, it's changing its identity of being in one state or the other one, so it has an internal spin structure in the sub-wavelength regions. The next approximation was this non-first-order adiabatic approximation, which gave rise to these little bumps. And we want to argue that these are the barriers at the end that we would like to insert and sort of use in a different context. And then, of course, we do, as an illustration here, the exact band structure and calculate lifetime for these states that we have over here due to the presence of these non-adiabatic couplings that we have to quantify. But of course, the point is always that by increasing my Rabi frequencies, I can move these states away as much as I want to, and therefore try to decrease the corresponding coupling, and that's also what we find. So here is an indication, the zero order. So if I got a particle that's moving, as I said, it's changing its identity, and we'll afterwards show you examples of many body physics that comes out over here, and I'll try to indicate it here. If you think of this being a spin, which is spin up and spin down, then you can sort of think of this like saying that, well, the magnetic dipole moment, because it is a, you know, in, if you're in one state, it's spin down, and if you're in another state, it's spin up, the way that I draw it over here, you can see that you're modulating the magnetic moment in space on the scale of these sub-wavelengths, okay? So this allows you to switch the spin and therefore the magnetic moment on the sub-wavelength scale. And this is happening, you know, depending on the ratio of these two Rabi frequencies that we have over here. So this is sort of, now, if I take out two particles and think about this in a quantum many-body sense, you can see that we have here space and we have these sub-wavelength regions. And if I have a single particle and it moves here, it will be spin down here. It goes here, spin up and spin down. If I put two particles in, like what you do over here, there would be a magnetic dipole moment that would now be spatially dependent, so it will be a problem of this type. And I have not added here the non-adiabatic correction here for the moment. You can see here that obviously we can get situations like when I draw over here, I know an atom, a first atom on this side will be spin down, and an atom over here, for example, this can form a bound state that you have here. And of course, it is a bound state, so if this is, I don't know, 30 nanometers, if I put the number over here, you can see that we have sort of like a molecule that can sort of sit at this domain wall between the spin-up and spin-down region, where the spin-up and spin-down attract each other. And you can see that if this particle wants to move over here, to maybe, you know, then collide with this one, if this one moves over here, it would, of course, then cross the domain wall and then go spin-up, and then it would be repulsive. So you sort of protect these things here by having, you know, different signs over here. So you get bound states that sit at the region of this, and notice that this distance over here is tens of nanometers. So it can be on the left or the right. You can, of course, also get things like, for example, trimers. Don't forget that these are distances now over here, which is this sub-wavelength distance L that we were discussing. Or if you orient the dipoles like this, this is now like you would have two wires that go up here. They can attract each other. So this is the bilayer physics that I mentioned at the very beginning. So whereas in standard, you know, optical lattices, when you talk about dipolar crystals and all of that, you talk about the situation where we have different layers and the distance between them would be lambda over 2. Now we have here a situation where these bound states molecules can move here on two wires. These are these sort of like the two planes that are over here, two wires. And, you know, there will be very strong hopping between them. So this is like making a two-side model where you have extremely small hopping because you essentially have here a sub-wavelength region. So if you do the first-order approximation, then you can sort of do the trivial and obvious. And it's like opening a textbook on quantum mechanics. This is like a chronic Wenning model that has a strength epsilon r recoil divided by epsilon. Epsilon is our smallness parameter that we have over here. So the spikes, these delta function spikes, are very high. And this is the area, the area that you have under these spikes over here. What's kind of interesting is this, that these spikes are pretty immune against laser noise. I think in practice, you would always derive your two Rabi frequencies from the same laser. So if you have laser noise and everything here depends on the ratio, this epsilon is the ratio to the two parameters, intensity noise, if it's slow, sufficiently slow, would actually cancel out this potential. So this should be extremely stable. And also it should be stable relative to laser bandwidth, because if you got the lambda transition and you got noise in one and then the other one and it's the identical noise, then also the laser bandwidth drops out. So in this sense, this should be rather stable. And you can also see that it's independent of detuning here that we get. So independent how far you detune. It's not entirely true if I take a realistic atom, and I can say something about these things. So that's true within the model that we have over here. Maybe I can say at the end a few remarks about how far we have to go, or maybe should go off resonance for some of these things still to be valid. And of course, validity is the Born-Oppenheimer approximation that we have to elaborate. So where is the usual sine square? Gives you these kind of band structures over here. This is more like a box potential. It goes like n squared. This is more like harmonic oscillator. And you can look up all of these things here in textbooks, and there's not really much to say about these things, except that this is the obvious. So people at the moment are very excited about box potentials for bosons and condensate. This is, if you want, sort of a mini box potential over here, given by now, in this case, it's just lambda over 2, of course, what we do. So we would use this barrier at the end that we insert into some other optical lattice, for example.
Actually, it does have an interesting feature, though, I think, because the level, if I can see correctly, one problem in stabilizing higher bands usually is in the normal sine squared cases, you can have exothermic forces.
This is n squared. Okay.
Right, and in there, yeah, no, it's exactly the opposite, and there you could not. So one problem in stabilizing p orbital physics and all these bosons always was that when two particles collide in the p bands, one goes down and one goes up because it's exothermic, because you gain more energy and you decay. And then here it's the opposite, actually. So you could not be able to decay. Yeah. So that's actually very interesting.
And the ground state over here usually tends to be very flat because you have to tunnel through this barrier, which can be huge, okay? And over here, of course, because you can have a very thin kind of a delta function, the tunneling can actually be much larger. So you can get all of these bands over here while still having a very large hopping amplitude relative to what you get in the normal case. So this may be interesting even on this level. Okay, so let me now say what Eo actually mentioned before, that one should do the complete problem. Let me show you now some numerical results where you just essentially solve this problem that we dive down here exactly by doing a Fourier decomposition and calculating the Bloch bands. So what's being done now here is this, that we make an ansatz. So we simply say, let's study decoherence by solving or sort of trying to extract from numerical calculations from the complete problem down here what the imaginary parts of these energies is that we normally calculate here in the band structure. This is an also relevant discussion if you want to use these barriers in terms of, you know, how lossy are they when you go through this because of non-adiabatic couplings. So you make a Bloch state ansatz like this, you know, plane wave out here. Note that we are solving a non-Hermitian eigenvalue problem. There's a gamma over here, but let's not elaborate on this. And then we get sort of a complex band structure out. And we couple now everything together. So in the Born-Oppenheimer Hamiltonian, notice that we got, of course, chronic Banach potentials over here that were separated by lambda over 2. And this gave us a lambda over 2 unit cell. Okay, so the band structure I showed you before was the band structure where it was just the usual kind of things that we draw over here. Notice that in the exact Hamiltonian, the symmetry is lambda as the unit cell. Okay, it includes 2. And so this means that all of these bands that we have over here will actually appear to sort of, you know, being folded back when we do the numerics over here because we got a different unit cell over here for the exact problem than what we have for the Born-Oppenheimer Hamiltonian. This was the picture I showed you before. This was the dark state. You can see the little bump. It's very much hidden here because I'm taking a certain Rabi frequency, and this is now some the bright state, and this is the other one. This would be sort of the standard optical lattice here. And this is the small bump, and in reality, that's of course quite large here. So let's understand now these non-adiabatic couplings. Non-adiabatic couplings will mean the following, that if a particle propagates over here, it can somehow scatter down here into this, then gain a lot of energy and then be lost. And of course, it will also be spontaneous emission. So whatever goes down here is sort of in this sense bad. And the way to understand it is this, that I can take the three states. So this would be if I do the Born-Oppenheimer approximation and calculate the whole band structure up here. And then I decouple this channel from this one. I would get the standard optical lattice over here, bright channel. And it would get the other one over here. And then this is sort of like in the continuum here. And what you do, if you do the full problem, is that you include now the dark state over here, which is coupled to these bright channels that are higher in threshold. And this is the one which is now lower in threshold. And we are interested in the energy region, which is down here. And then we are asking how large is the coupling, you know, of these states over here into these states, because this is the one which has the loss, and this is the one which is bad. So if you couple over here, then you're dead. Okay, and the question is how big is now the imaginary part for this thing over here? And of course, the idea is now by taking the Rabi frequency sufficiently large, we can make this thing as small as we want.
Sorry, can you explain this again? I can understand. So the dark channel, this is the band structure of my...
This was the Born-Oppenheimer that we talked about before, this lowest order.
Okay.
That's right. And then I'm, so if I go back to this one, so we calculate the...
Let me just ask you, if you're in an asymmetric situation, that's on purpose. You didn't want to go on resonance, so it's not on resonance, right?
This is not on resonance, that's right. Okay. So this is for the blue detuning in this case, so the upper one sort of comes down and the other one... Actually, this is the one which is dangerous because this channel is always closed. So actually going to the blue side is better here than the red side. No, because then you're moving this thing further down.
Can you go back to the potential here just for a second? So it's the E plus we're talking about, is the upper one, and we're talking about the band, the energy levels.
Right, and we're interested in this thing here. And you can see that if I move this one further and further away, then,
okay.
I mean, the further it is away, which is the blue detuning, you know, it helps you to suppress this thing.
Okay, so okay. What you're plotting just is just the high energies of the
exactly.
zero and
exactly.
the minus bands
right.
shifted
uh-huh.
by their relative
that's
position.
Right. Exactly.
And now you're trying to see when is the zero band in resonance with what state
that's
of
right.
the bands.
Okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was this part here, and then we said we switched on the coupling, and I've now blown up this region over here. And this is the one that we have over here. This is a standard band structure that we have that now gets a finite lifetime by coupling. You can see that over here we are in a region where this is free particles because this is far above the barrier for the other one. So this is a very high energy in this channel over here. And the question is now, how big is this coupling? And then we do exactly what you actually said earlier, that you put in this alpha prime and all of these things, calculate the couplings, you do it exactly and ask what's the lifetime. Here's an example. Okay, so this is the standard dispersion relation for the lowest Bloch band, and now it gets a certain width. And the first interesting part about this is that this width that you find over here is actually Q-dependent. Normally you would expect that the width should be independent of the velocity, but actually this makes a lot of sense because this is like doing stirrup. When you get a particle that's moving faster and faster, the non-adiabatic corrections get larger. Okay, and this is manifest here, the fact that here, at the point Q equal to zero, is essentially stable. And if you walk out here, this is sort of walking up the Bloch band, it is largest at the end, at the edge. So if you unfold this thing, it's like saying that your standard Bloch band has a larger loss rate at the end, which is higher energies, the particles are moving faster than in the middle. Okay? And so this by itself could actually be interesting because it would mean that if you load something like this in a mod insulator, you would sort of deplete all of the higher Q values, and at the end you would sort of contract and get a condensate just by filtering if you want to. So the faster the atom, the higher the loss, and Q equal to zero is actually stable. So if you do physics, which is down here, then you're completely immune against this kind of loss, and otherwise you have a certain loss, but it turns out that this is for the parameters that you can choose, this you can make this as small as you want to. Okay, so in this sense, we can even go on resonance and nonetheless get a stable Bloch band structure out. There's something else going on over here that's sort of indicated in this figure. Maybe just indicate over here. For certain Q values, you can find resonances over here, and I don't want to elaborate on this, but just say that, you know, we understand that there will be resonances over here for the coupling to some of these other states that appear over there. So this by itself can be interesting, that we can make a loss structure that's Q-dependent. You can filter out certain Q states here. So it's like a Q filter that you have. In quasi-momentum, you can deplete certain windows of your... in your brilliant zone that you have here.
The standard situation would be the above one, right? I mean, spontaneous emission usually the state is large bandwidth, and probably your non-adiabatic couplings will always be smaller.
Right. So this is a special situation for this. So I can explain what's really behind it. But so we only say we find resonances, and we find the generic situation, which is the one which is up here. So we find certain resonances. So I'm almost done now, sort of conclude by saying a few words about bound states, interfaces, this domain wall molecule. So let's do this problem now and sort of show you results. If you take this sub-wavelength structure over here and you put one particle that's up and down, we can see that we can have a molecule here, we can also have a molecule over here, and we can solve essentially this equation here, which is an equation where we have a potential now, but in D, these dipole moments depend now on the spatial coordinate x1. And the dependence that we have over here can change in space on the scale, which is this, as I called it, nanometer scale. Okay?
What's VNA? That's the potential?
This is the non-adiabatic potential that I wrote down here before. Now we can do some many-body physics, and of course we will get bound states. The interesting part is this, that of course the scale on which all of these things happen over here I said before, if you take a standard lattice and you look at these interactions over the scale of one of a lambda over two spacing, then they are something like 80 hertz, to say a number. But over here, since you do these things in a scale which is much smaller, so even magnetic interactions can become huge. So giving rise to all of these things. So we have analyzed, you know, of course, calculating the bound states. It's not very difficult to do. Just look at this and also look at the hopping over here. This is would be like a two-side model for this molecule that can sit over here, you know, can sort of hop between those places. And because the distance here can be made this nanoscale, you can look at the energy scale and the relevant energy scale. If you look at these hoppings, is this. Normally, you would write down the recoil energy as a, you know, mass, and then there would be lambda squared, and lambda would be the wavelengths of the light. But now we get L, which is the sub wavelength lattice. Okay, so the recoil energy is replaced by a quantity that's larger by epsilon squared relative to the normal recoil. So we have energy scales that are extremely favorable relative to the standard situation. And you can also look at then at the bare hopping. So the hopping of this molecule over here, because the distance is so small, is now sort of a two-side problem. They can get hoppings that are now measured in units of this new. They are not limited by the recoil energy as before, but limited by ER divided by epsilon squared. So this is orders of magnitude better than what one normally has. And maybe at the end, this can be useful for seeing, you know, certain quantum phases that require very low temperatures, which in our case is big energy scales.
So you're imagining a one-dimensional problem?
At the moment, I've been talking about one dimension, yeah.
So I guess I want to, like, so you showed this dipole interaction between the two, the ones outside and inside the region. Mm-hmm. But what about, I mean, are you thinking one particle per minimum?
Okay, so we can do this if I really draw this thing and I don't have any confinement. The other direction, you can think of this like being a pipeline that comes out here and that's sort of two wires.
Right.
So we do a situation where we have two wires that are close together like this. 30 nanometers to say a number, okay, or maybe then the bilayer system like this. The bilayer would be for free, otherwise you need.
So I'm thinking of the repulsive dipole interaction within the region.
This would be like the one that I had earlier over here, so this would be.
Well, within that region.
Already the dipoles this way?
No, just like over here.
Yeah.
There's a dipole interaction between two blue ones.
Well, this is for me one molecule, and this is the other one. And so this one hops over here.
I mean, the regions, the narrow regions of size L have spin up.
That's right. They have spin
up.
And
the red regions have spin down.
That's right. The other ones
spin up. Confined to those regions.
Well, if I have a single particle, of course, it would just have the band structure before. You know, right. It would be a single one that would be spin down here,
right.
Goes up and down. It would be the band structure before. There would not be any bound states. But if I put two of them, you know, they can bind here together by the interaction on the domain wall, if you want to call it like this, which is given by one Rabi frequency becoming larger or smaller than the other.
I guess
one.
I'm just wondering about role of repulsive dipole interaction.
This is part of this equation. What you're telling me is this, that if there's an atom over here, this will be attractive here. But if this one really wants to move very close, it has to move to the other region, then it will flip, and then they will repel each other.
Right.
So there's built-in repulsion, which is actually very good, because you want to shield it at small distances from loss. So this is a feature, I would say, in this context over here. You're shielding it from close range interactions, because you're flipping the spin, then it becomes repulsive. But over the scale L, it is attractive over here by this spatial modulation that one has. So we can do all of these things, and the energy scales look good, and you can calculate the wave function. Now I'm sort of at the end. I can tell you a little bit about loading, how to load these things, and also about measurement and loss from the many atom situation. This is actually a rather complicated atomic physics problem. I think it would be rather interesting if you can really put atoms in the controlled way now close together on the scale of, say, 30 nanometers. It would become interesting also from a quantum chemistry point of view. But, you know, this question, what happens then to loss at these small distances and in many atom setting coming from many atom light-induced collisions, I mean, this is sort of a topic on its own. I think that in the dipolar case, we are kind of protected by this built-in shielding and so on. Let me also mention that if instead of a lambda system, I take now a zigzag, you know, two lambda systems. Before we had one bump. This is a sub-wavelength bump. You can see that I'm filling in. Now we get sort of, you know, one over here and here. So in a system like this, there's again a dark state, but the switching over of the spin from here to over here happens so rapidly that you even get a double well over here. So we get substructure. So we get now potential wells that are smaller than the sub-wavelength region we were talking about here before. So this is an even one energy, one spatial scale smaller if you want to. And we can do this thing then for different M and sort of, you know, people always talk about synthetic dimension. And this is sort of like doing a synthetic dimension in space where we take the standard lambda over two lattice and we subdivide it now not in the other direction, so to say, but we use this to get sort of a spatial dimension. So this is like a patchwork that you have over here. And here's my last slide, which I find quite amusing, and this goes in a completely different way. We can use these kind of ideas to construct, so this is work by Dayu Yang, our group, and we have not written this up yet. This is just want to tell you what the ideas are. This is an attempt to make sort of a sub-wavelength microscope, but you would like to do this thing as a non-demolition microscope, sort of like an in vivo. You know, people always like to see living cells without destroying them. So we would like to watch atoms and in a microscope but not destroy them, like what we do at the moment. And here's sort of what the idea is. I'll try to summarize it in the most simple form. Imagine that we make a sub-wavelength region over here and think of a free atom that's moving in space. So this atom is initially over here, and these are my two laser beams that define the spatial region. What it means is that an atom going through here will be spin up, will be spin down, goes here, spin up in this very small region, and then goes spin down again. And the question is, how can we detect this thing? Well, the answer is now that, you know, the atom knows that it is inside this region over here because it has a different internal state, and this is something that we can try to detect in a non-destructive way. So one way of doing this would be that, suppose that I put this thing in a cavity over here. Some people have now, you know, like Tilman Estiger, for example, you take a light and reflect it. And if you take a normal cavity resonance over here, this would be the laser frequency. You go to cavity resonance. Of course, if you go to one of these points over here, you're filling this cavity with light from the laser. But if your atom is going through over here, you're changing over to the other state. So if I tune my cavity over here of resonance, but nonetheless, this is like an AC star shift, what I will get is this. This atom is going through. Maybe I should try to do this again. So this is going through here. So this means that while this is going through here, this goes over and then goes back. So it picks up a phase over here. But if I plot this again down here, this means that the cavity is shifting back and forth. And so if I have a laser, you know, the reflected phase of the laser will sort of see the little blip inside, detecting in time how the atom is flying through this zone. So this would be a non-destructive microscope that detects the motion of the atom on the sub-wavelength scale. And there would be a lot to say about these things, but maybe I just leave it at this. This would be an example of doing continuous measurement theory, where you do standard quantum optics for these measurements out here, analyzing the homodyne detection that you have here, where the current over here of homodyne detection would be then an indication of the motion of the microscope. And of course, there will be quantum back action on this thing. All of these things one has to calculate, take into account. But in quantum optics, we have the language for describing these things. Of course, it's a microscope that only works on one point. Would be nice, like what Manuel has to do it in parallel in all of them. I don't see how to generalize this thing immediately to this situation, but having a sort of an in vivo microscope for atomic motion with a sub-wavelength resolution by itself may even be quite interesting. Okay, so with this I'm done. Thank you.
I have two questions. So, what was the width of compared this loss width for the Dirac parameter? How did it compare to the bandwidth?
So we could make it. So, if you allow me to take the Rabi frequencies large, we can make this as small as you want to. You know, it will be a small fraction of the bandwidths. So we can make it as small as we want to.
So you just increase the splitting to the.
I just increase the splitting, which means that you're cranking up the Rabi frequency, and then you move the state more and more away, and then these matrix elements get smaller and smaller because they have to oscillate faster and faster, and then so we can. This was. So in the paper that we wrote, what we wrote is simply that we were optimizing these parameters so that we could just see them here. But you can take in an experiment whatever you want to make this width over here much smaller. We just wanted to make it visible here. Yeah.
Now, one fundamental thing at the end I want to understand better. When you talk about the layer physics, when we really want to benefit from this narrow spike, it's really the layer physics you talked about at the interface, right? It's not in the double well, because first you sketch
that's
the barrier
right.
with the double well, because then I'm not going to get much.
Yeah. So actually, in the paper, what we did was to do this problem.
The interface. Just so I don't confuse what layers we actually talk about. Because you had this picture in the beginning, the double well with the spike in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not really.
Okay, so I don't have any results here, but we essentially also solved this. So I just showed this domain wall as one example, but we actually solve also the other case of these double spikes where we get two wires. So.
And then I understand it, but just in the double well picture you showed with the spike there, if you just think about one layer being the left well node and the other layer, then you don't really gain. It's really the interface physics you talked about, right? Where you.
No, I mean, this is, let me see. So.
This
distance over here, I know we are sort of getting greedy here in the sense that the domain molecules, they would sit on the boundary over here. There also this thing over here would be the scale of 30 nanometers here. So these are two wires over here that go into the board.
Okay.
And their distance is then.
But not as narrow as the layer
that's
interface.
That's fine, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But from an experimental point of view, it may be sort of more realistic than if I put two atoms over here, they will actually attract each other. If the dipoles go like this, they would form a bound state, and this is like a double layer.
Estimate is just half the ground state wave function of that.
That's right, exactly. Right.
You said it was actually L0 was a fundamental limit, the transversal of finally, you didn't explain that.
Well, it is a fundamental limit if you do many-body physics, and it's very much related if you do, for example, polar molecules, and you think of this physics that you want to confine it in the 2D plane, then you have this situation that if you can take two dipoles like this, they will repel each other. But if you have a finite extension in the third direction, which you always have, you can go like that, and there will be a similar problem over here. It appears only in a many-body case, so the single particle is completely stable. So in the single particle, you can take your sub-wavelength resolution down to whatever you want it to be. But for the many-body situation, there may be other constraints that come in that are sort of familiar from there. We have some other answers for this. Okay.
So how should I view it? As a quasi-one-dimensional system or as planes?
You can do both.
So for the quasi-one-dimensional, what will be the delta function?
The quasi one dimensional, what will be the delta function?
Because if the delta function is actually in three dimensions and not a plane.
No, this is all, which delta function you talk about? This is not the Lieb-Lindinger model.
Function that you have in the chronic plane.
Yes, okay. I mean, this chronic panic delta function. It's over here. This is a very well-defined, analytical form.
And how does it, now in reality, how is it in Y? Is it just independent of
Y? You would, in this case, I mean, this is usual. If I would like to reduce it, for example, by having some other transverse confinement from a standard light beam, that I just make very, very strong. And then you would just multiply this thing by the, integrate these things out.
Okay, so you have a delta in the plane. Okay.
I discussed the one-dimensional model. I would say that the other direction I can sort of argue away if I would like to integrate it out in the usual way by strong confinement. And then even think about doing a similar trick now in the other direction. So this is only for simplicity here of explaining it, where this thing comes from. Okay.
The other directions you're not, let's say you're using conventional mechanisms to confine, be as tight. So then
it depends how strong you crank these things up. But this could be exactly one of these limitations that Emmanuel mentioned. But we can, in principle, so if you allow me to do, for example, two layers, with free motion along this plane, we can do a double layer.
Right.
And this double layer will be sub-wavelength distance.
Yeah, so that's fine. I just mean confining transversely in a y and z direction?
No, you're right. Ah. The model that I write down over here assumes that in y and z it's also confined tightly to essentially being able to argue that it's like this, and then some of these potentials will be modified by this, you know, other spatial extent in the way that we understand it. But this was to explain the this underlying analytical structure.
So it will be such a function as a function of y times such a function of z.
Well, the usual thing is that you sort of have to smear these things out by over integrating with this transverse confinement function.
Okay.
I think that's clear what to ask.
So can one imagine to do the same along the three directions or say two?
Yes, you can do it. Yeah, that's right. No, that's fine. Yes, you can play tricks also, you know, with laser coming from other directions and
tap into the.
Yeah, no. I think that there's many possibilities to play the same trick in different and more than
so
one spatial dimension.
The,
yeah. So it's easy to get, for example, in 2D, if you plot these things, it's easy. Here we got some wavelength regions over here, and what you would get is sort of like, you would get an array of little spikes. These are some wavelength delta functions that you have now in two dimensions where you scatter off. So you would get immediately this thing here.
But then you have to do something more sophisticated.
I mean,
the boundary conditions, because the delta function.
No.
The more than one dimension.
I don't have a delta function. For me, these are very smooth functions that are very regular. And the only thing that I'm doing is this, that this coherent control field, I make a function of x and y, and we know how to do that.
Okay.
So the delta function is for me an approximation to illustrate it to make connection with standard textbook like Connie Bennett. Yeah.
This goes also back to Emmanuel's first question. Somehow this even what you say here, two dimension, makes a lot of sense because I think you can avoid mostly at least to the first order for the kind of too many faults that you look at the problem of light shifts if you come with your two lasers from different directions, right? Because they just couple different transitions. Which is still possible in two dimensions, but I don't know how you would do that in three.
To be honest, I mainly thought about two dimensions where you get things like this. I still find it rather cute in the sense that you get a delta function here. If you take a standard optical lattice, it's like having a standard well, and you sort of put a peak in the center, and you can even modulate this thing, you know. It gets sort of the most, I guess this would be the smallest racetrack that people ever designed, or at least as theorists. No, I'm completely with you when it comes to all of these dark shifts, and at the end, I think this will be the limitation of what the smallest L will be.
So probably it's very naive and it's not going to work. But if you have this spike separated by half a wavelength, but they are spiked, then could you do some stroboscopic motion?
Well, this was the very original idea, and we never came around actually calculating this. And I'm sure that there's a hierarchy of timescales.
Yeah.
So when we talked with Misha, this was the original. Not in the context of these potentials. We always thought about standard Stark shift at that point. So this was years ago. So this geometric one. But you're completely right that and this is on the to-do list, and a student actually is supposed to do it even right now. I really would like to finally understand that if you stroboscopically, do these things here, then you get any sub-wavelength structure that you want. And it's a question of time scale. And I guess that it's just a question that if you allow me Rabi frequencies to take it large as possible, I can move all of these time scales to be then at the end reasonable. So. And this would be great because it would be free space, optical structures that are on this, as I like to call it, nanoscale. But nano should always be put in a quote because this is not one nanometer. This is, the scale of this 30 or whatever nanometers. But it's still much better than the standard wavelengths.
Is there a classical interpretation of this force or this bumps? I mean, in the optical dipole force, I've always explained to the students, it's like a classical oscillator. You oscillate, it oscillates in phase, 180 degrees out of phase, so minus d dot e. Even classically, I can explain the AC Stark shift perfectly nicely in this way. Optical lattices without making any use of comes quantum mechanics. If you just explain it with an oscillator picture, is there?
I think it's sort of similar to these geometric forces that people have discussed, you know, with Berry phases and all of that. And it's sort of somehow related.
I mean, an intuitive picture.
So when I hear Berry phase, I would say it's probably has to do with the wave nature. So, yeah.
Okay, I think that thanks for the many questions and for the great talk.
Okay.